Hello?
And then if you want to click that arrow right there.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yep, we sure can.
Can you see me video?
Yes, I sure can.
How can you not see it? You won't show me, huh?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to mute you for now.
So I don't have to mute. You'll control that for me?
Yes.
Okay.
So this is the one where I don't hit that.
Yeah. And I'm not.
Because it doesn't want to always click this. Give it a second. Okay. Now get rid of it. Get rid of it.
Okay. All right. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the North Dakota Medical Association's weekly Wednesday webinar. I'm Courtney Coble. I'm Executive Director of the North Dakota Medical Association. And on behalf of NDMA, I'd like to thank everybody on this call for attending this webinar and especially for your membership and commitment to NDMA. In COVID news this week, from my end, North Dakota is getting ready to open up. Yesterday, Governor Burgum announced guidelines for restaurants and personal care facilities. This week, I've been participating in meetings with long-term care, the hospitals, and DHS about combining surge plans of the long-term care facilities and hospitals. A proposal was floated early on to transfer all COVID positive, no matter what the symptoms, from the nursing home to the hospital. After a few meetings, it has been straightened out and with considerable input from physicians. And we will have more about this in our e-physician tomorrow. President Misty Anderson and I worked with Senator Hovind's office this week regarding his joining a letter asking Medicare to increase reimbursement for audio-only services. And then finally, in health alert news, COVID-19 was added to the post-mortem communicable disease list, and NDDOH announced that COVID-19 is a reportable condition, with all persons tested, both negative and positive, to be reported to the North Dakota Department of Health. There's also new testing guidance with advice to test all individuals with a cough, shortness of breath, or difficulty breathing. That concludes my updates. I'm sure we're ready to hear more from our panelists. Tonight's panelists are, of course, Joan Connell, Tim Mahoney, and Avish Nagpal. Dr. Connell is the field medical officer at the North Dakota Department of Health and leads the physician advisory group on COVID-19. Dr. Mahoney is a surgeon from Fargo who specializes in general, vascular, and advanced laparoscopic procedures, and he's also mayor of Fargo. Dr. Nagpal practices internal medicine, specializing in infectious disease and travel and tropical medicine in Sanford, Fargo. After our panelists talk, we will have the opportunity for questions and open discussions. Please type your question in the question box or raise your hand, and I'll unmute you if necessary. Thanks again. And I'll hand it over to Joan.
Good evening, everyone. I hope everyone is having a great week. So I'm probably going to recap a lot of what Courtney said, because I think we've been working on the same things from different angles. Big news had to do with the long-term care facilities and exactly what our plan should be. And I would just augment what Courtney said with the fact that we also added recommendations for doing advanced directives using the PULSED crisis guidelines. And those are available, I think Courtney posted them in the NDMA newsletter, so you can take a look at those. But they look like they would be very useful in having a discussion with an elderly person about what they would want done in an emergent situation. The other thing we spend a lot of time talking about in the physician advisory group this week was the fact that PPE really is a rate limiting step potentially in our reopening because we don't have endless supplies. So I did hear some news that we got closer to a decontamination source today. Some sort of trailer arrived, and I'm not sure if it's for UV or for vaporized hydrogen peroxide. So I'll know more, and you probably will too. We'll know more too next week. The other thing that has come up is obviously the reopening and how that affects everybody. So in my office, I'm challenged / struggling with deciding how to deliver a hybrid version of telehealth and the live visits so I can get the critical physical exam stuff that I can't do via telehealth while minimizing transmissible moments. So if anybody wants to talk about what you're doing in your offices, if you have those common goals, I would love to hear from you. With respect to the rest of you, we spend a lot of time talking about testing. And I was involved in the recent testing guidelines that Courtney read. And serology testing was a big part of that discussion at the end of last week and this week, because at the end of last week, companies were asking for these serology tests so that they could know who was immune, so they could put them on the front lines and not worry about PPE. And so it was quite a significant amount of education that needed to be provided to remind people that we don't know if antibodies are protective, number one. Number two, if they are protective, we don't know how long the immunity lasts. And number three, the majority of the tests that are now currently available have specificities that are such that you are as likely or possibly more likely to get a false positive than a true positive. And some of that is due to prevalence, and some of it is due to the fact that sometimes these antibody tests cross-react with benign coronavirus viruses. So that was quite an effort, and we were really concerned about that for the public's safety. So now the testing issues that are coming up involve quotations from the governor. If somebody wants a test, they should be able to get a test, which is not exactly in line with the guidelines that Courtney read to you. So that'll probably be a discussion for tomorrow. It crosses into the testing the asymptomatic person for whatever reason. And then this overlaps with a lot of surgeons wanting pre-op testing available of asymptomatics to make sure that they're not infected with coronavirus. And the reasoning for that would be to decrease risk to your staff and other patients, but also because recent publications indicate that doing elective surgery on asymptomatic patients who are positive with coronavirus has a big morbidity and mortality risk associated with it. So we'll have to make some recommendations about that, but those really hinge on having a firm understanding of how many tests we really have available at our disposal, based on how much the lab can tolerate now. So those are probably, one final thing we worked on was our convalescent plasma project. And that was really exciting because we had some patients in our state discharged after receiving convalescent plasma. So great for them. And one of my goals was to really promote this by putting the word out. So we talked about it at a press conference yesterday. There was a press release after that. And then hopefully the plan is for a letter to go out to all of the patients who go into the recovering or recovered category to let them know about this program and how to donate plasma if they so desire. So those are the big news from the Capitol.
Thanks, Joan. Does anyone have any questions for Joan before we move to the next person? We have one. All right, Dr. Kumar has a question. So I will unmute him. All right, Dr. Kumar, go ahead.
Joan, how about knowing that, how do we know that convalescent plasma is the one that worked? Because I'm kind of worried about not having a randomized controlled trial. Is the patient getting better on its own and convalescent plasma was coincidental? Are we, because there is so much of medications that are initially proved useful and later not. So is there a mechanism in NOT DAGODA that can tell us that it was the convalescent plasma that led to the discharge of the patient?
So that is a great question. I think there are two ways that a physician can acquire convalescent plasma. One is through applying for an EIND through the FDA. And the other is being part of the Mayo Expanded Access Clinical Trial. So that the latter is obviously the way to study this. And right now, if you look at the clinical goals of the Mayo trial, basically it's just about safety. And I think they did it that way so that it could go through the IRB more easily and they could get this up and running. But when you read through the plans and when you speak with Dr. Joyner, it sounds like they have a lot of plans of doing more intensive study, and it's probably not going to be double-blinded, placebo-controlled, but it will be better than we have 5 patients and they got it and they all got discharged. So that means it's amazing, which is basically what we have now. Although there are two papers from China now. The last one was, or the most recent one, I found about a week ago. So I think it's hopeful, but I also think it's funny because I'm the biggest downturn person about the serology testing, yet I'm the most excited about the convalescent plasma. So that tells me you how crazy all of this is, actually. and then I will just one more nerdy thing. Another paper I found last weekend, which just really adds to this, Dr. Kumar, is if you look at plasma or antibody response, the older you are, the more antibodies you make. In a series of, I think it was 113 patients classified as having mild disease. So how does that fold into the convalescent plasma? And whose do you want? The 80-year-olds who's got tons and tons of antibodies, or the 20-year-old? and I will have to see.
All right, thanks, Joan. Dr. Booth has a question. I've unmuted you. I think, Dr. Booth, I think you have to unmute yourself.
Okay, I'll start over.
Perfect.
Okay, thanks for the update, Joan. You said earlier in your presentation that having a coronavirus antibody, or the coronavirus antibody, say COVID-19 specifically, doesn't necessarily confer immunity. How do you square that with these convalescent plasma cases?
That's what I was saying, is I am so concerned about, we really need to prove that that this is protective, but let's give everyone convalescent plasma, and I realize that is a dichotomy that I can't explain, except maybe it's sleep deprivation. I don't know.
Maybe it is evidence, but I wouldn't, from my scientific training, I wouldn't consider it conclusive either.
Yeah.
Probably the more important question is, if we do have a 50% false positive rate with these tests, are there follow-up tests that one should use in the case of a positive to verify that it's a true positive?
Well, that's an interesting question. And both Paul Carson and Dr. Burks independently came up with the suggestion of testing twice separately. So, you know, like a month apart. And if it was positive twice, then that would be more reliable. So I think that's one thing to do. The other thing is when we open up, I don't know what you guys think, but I'm guessing that the prevalence in the state will dramatically increase, and that will decrease the false positive rate of the test. So this might fix itself statistically.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, we have one question in the question. Dr. Green asks, any reason to think there will be use of remdesivir considering Dr. Fauci recently backed the drug with favorable preliminary results? Where does this fit in?
Yeah, well, it's funny because I haven't read a lot about remdesivir because it's not available. You can only get it through compassionate use, and in March they said they're not doing that anymore, or if you're in a multi-center clinical trial, which nobody in North Dakota is involved with. So that I was kind of focused on other stuff. But recently I decided I better read a little bit more about that. And it sounds like that's the most promising antiviral agent. So I think, you know, the FDA is going to do the process that we want it to do, that we ask it to do, so that we have solid information before the drug is released for commercial use, and I appreciate that. But the downside of that is that's going to be a while before it's probably available to our patients in North Dakota.
All right, thank you. All right, Dr. Mahoney, I'm going to unmute you. I'll hand it over to you, our next panelist.
Hi, how's everybody doing tonight? Thank you for tuning in. The challenges, I was asked a little bit by Courtney, there's the challenges of being mayor and a surgeon. And I know there's a lot of people on tonight that are internists, family practice, different areas where you deal with little different problems than we do in surgery. So the difficulty for me to interpret what's going on is all these graphs and all these predictions and all these things that people put out there. So I would just hold up a graph here, just kind of, you've all seen this, you've seen some kind of graph in front of you. So about a month ago when we started looking at that, I had graphs predicting that we would peak June 15th. I had graphs showing us that we'd go all through May and continue to climb, and June 15th we'd hit the peak. So if you ask a population of 120,000 to stay at home, stay healthy, stay connected for a month, that's a big ask to ask your community. When we originally started with this, it's really hard because in medicine, as we all know, usually things are predictable. You get pneumonia, you treat it, you get better. You take your appendix out, you get better. This one was one of those things, I have no idea where it's going to go. We don't know what's going to happen. And what's hard for me in the death count is oftentimes patients are refusing treatment. So are they really, do we have high mortality as you see there? Or is it because they're do not resuscitate, do not add extra ventilators or anything like that? So some of our death count is just because people refuse any kind of treatment. But we don't get that in the news. We don't get that information. So we early on decided, and I talked to Mike Brown as well, and I talked to Dick Johnson in Devil's Lake, and said the only way we're going to make this thing work, if I look at those graphs, is hit it hard when you first have that happen. So we did a directive to the community that we needed people to stay home, and we said they would save lives. That was our mantra, is just save lives, and you all could be lifesavers. We also tried to add something cute, because we have a population of 31.5 is the average age in Fargo. So we said, save your summer. We tried to get to their, what do they really want? They want a great summer. So if we make them do bad things in April, they can get their summer back. So we tried to get to what is the core thing here to get people to stay at home and do the things they need to do. We also had our entrepreneurs do an ad campaign that was more to that liking.
And we got great response from that, where a lot of kids tuned in, did that, and tried to do those things. So approximately 3 weeks ago, we did a directive through the community and said, we want you to really take this seriously. And it's amazing when you start asking people to do that, because oftentimes then the question is, okay, Tim, if I'm down at the basketball court and I'm with my 20 buddies and we're playing basketball, you're going to kick me off the court. And, you know, you don't want to be a big bully, but you have to say, yes, we're going to kick you off the court because we don't want that many people being together. And so as a politician, you get questions, which sometimes as a physician, as physicians, we sometimes, we know the right answer, the right message to give people, but you sometimes got to be the bad guy. You got to be, no, we're really going to do this because we really want this to turn out well. So I was very pleased in our community. We did 1,000 patients out at the Fargo Dome, and our positive rate was 4%. That tells me people are doing a good job at doing that. And doggone, you know what happened is about 200 of those people came over from Minnesota. They tried to make my numbers look bad, but it didn't happen. So it kind of works out sometimes when you do that. So now when we start to open up businesses, then we get the counter. As you're opening too quickly, this virus isn't done, it's going to come back, these are going to happen. And it's also that balance of what do you do? Sometimes the society feels you're being too restrictive, you're holding them back. And we do have some naysayers, even though this has hit our communities and hit different places. I had one commissioner said, well, more drunk drivers die than they'll die from the virus. So it was kind of an odd analogy, but there was some of this disbelief that this just can't hit us or can't hit our community. Most of those naysayers are gone because they've seen it. It did come. We are seeing it. We're getting positive. Now, the other point, now you start to open up and what are you going to do? And what's hard for me as a physician is to look at the models. So you can look at Ascension's model, Santra's model, you can look at the Washington model, and you can look at Burgum's model, and all four are different, and all four have different things that are gonna happen. So on the testing today, test for positives is 2.2%. Well, that would mean we're headed the right direction if we're down to that low value. And I think Burgum has picked up is you gotta test people. Because we could have 15% of our population positive, but we don't know about it until we test. So what I've encouraged from the state is now we are going to test. We're going around and doing that. Now we're going to be aggressive. And then you get into those tricky questions, which I think Joan alluded to a little bit. In nursing homes, you take the sick patients from nursing homes, put them in the hospital, and isolate them away from the people in the nursing home. And in 2009, we took patients out of their nursing homes, and we had a death rate we didn't expect. So what happened when we took people out of their own environment, they sometimes didn't do well. And we went back and looked at the 30-day survival rate. And we were surprised to find a fair amount of deaths in that by moving people. The elderly don't always do well with that. But yet you have a capacity in which we've only used 25 beds. And we have 750 beds in the Fargo-Moorhead area we could use. So it's kind of like, okay, we're doing too much. The other interesting thing is on the unintended consequences. You don't want to panic your population, but you want your population to be confident we can beat this. So one day the state comes by and puts 200 cots in a Fargo Dome. Well, you would think the world fell apart because all of a sudden we were preparing for something if it really got bad. But you know, the Fargo Dome is kind of sacred area. That's like 7 times national champions, and you don't disturb that turf. So it's one of those things is that that gets out to the public and they go, oh my God, the world's falling apart because you put something on the turf at NDSU. So that's what I call unintended consequences. You have to message that right so people understand what you're prepared for. Although, you know, the numbers don't show that, but this doesn't happen. And then the other element that's fun as a politician is I have never met so many experts. You know, you guys get that sometimes? There are so many experts. And when Trump says, drink Lysol, I'm going, oh my God, as a surgeon, please don't do that. Yep, somebody went out and tried that stuff. It doesn't taste very good. You know, you just get those kind of crazy things that happen. So I'm always very cautious when these experts come to me and you try to figure, okay, where are they coming from? You know, did they go to medical school or are they a statistician or kind of what's their background? Because, you know, you got things like Mahoney, you really don't know how to do this. You don't understand statistics. And I'm going, okay. Show me yours. We'll see what happens. But it has really been fun to watch all the experts. And that's one really frustrating thing about COVID virus is not knowing the answers. All of us as physicians, usually somebody comes to you with a problem and you're a problem solver. And this has not been an easy one to solve. And that's just like whenever we have the plasma or something. So my police chief comes to me one day and he says, Tim, I want to test all my policemen if they have antibodies. Because I got 160 guys in the force, and I find out who has the antibody, then they can work in certain areas and these other people don't have to. So it's amazing how people do that thought process. So of course I go to my medical experts. And again, it's like Joan says, we're not sure what that means, if they do have immunity or not, or don't have immunity. And we have the problem now, some of our clients have a tendency, they've learned that we get a little frightful of spit, we get a little frightful of people, you know, sneezing on you or doing those types of things. The police now are gone or have masks on and they gloves on when they're meeting clients. But that's been kind of a little game I've had along some of my clients that are downtown, like to try to frighten the policemen. But Chief Todd does make a good point. Is there a way that you could find out who is protected and who is not, and you could manage your manpower a little bit different on that? And those are some of the challenges you get into, and what's the right answer. And of course, I have to rely on our medical experts to know what's going on. I think overall, the state of North Dakota has done very well. I give us top grades. We're in the top 10 states in the nation. You have to go, this would be hard for us all. We'd have to go to Hawaii to do better. Alaska's doing really well as well. But you'd have to be on an island and be always away from people. So be happy that you're in North Dakota. We're doing a great job. I'm very pleased with how things are going. And I'm hoping the experts that keep those curves down are the ones that this virus follows. I'm not sure if it will, but that's the one we're hoping for. So I'd be open to any questions, but it's been interesting to watch. Courtney, I can't hear you. You're saying?
So in you, we have a very good combination of somebody who is a physician and also in the politics. What is your opinion about opening up?
Well, we've been watching this closely, and what I'm getting is people are going stir crazy right now. I mean, they think they've done the right thing, and so what's happened is they're trying to balance that. And it was a little frightful when it went up to 90 cases in the state, and then we're kind of watching. And I call it, if you're a walleye fisher, you understand this, is you're bottom bouncing. So as long as you're bottom bouncing, you're okay. If you bottom bounce and go 40-20, 40-20, or keep low. At one time, one of my experts told me that when we really got into this disease, we would double the number every 4 days. And if you did that, you would see the 90, you go 180, you'd be 300, we'd really be going up. That has not happened. And actually, the governor gave 8 different paradigms of what he was looking at. And surprisingly enough, we have hit those paradigms to be able to open up. The second issue is, how confident are you right now if we went out to dinner? Would you take you and your wife out to a restaurant right now? I don't think it's going to come back full bore right away. It's opened up 50%. I think people will kind of watch and see that that happens. And the veiled threat behind it is the governor's kind of said, we'll see all the numbers do, and then we'll decide what we do. So I think what will happen is communities have to get some confidence in this. But part of what we balance with that, our economy is not doing very well right now. You try to balance that, you try to balance well-being, you know, and domestic violence, suicides, those types of things come into that element as well. We have to learn to live with this virus. We have to learn how to combat it and take care of it. And I think what we're gonna be is aggressive in testing. And I think that's really a lot of the key is you find the people that are positive and get them out of the community and the cycling. You have people do the social distancing, masks, doing those types of things. And in our grocery stores, I say it's 50-50. And I had one of the more frightening things happen to me that in your medical careers, things happen. And you go, oh, I didn't really want that to happen. I was in a grocery store walking around and this little old lady comes up and he runs over and gives me a hug. And I'm going, you don't do this right now. This is what you do. And so, I mean, I see some people doing the right thing and I see others not. But the reality is if you start to open up, South Dakota has been open the whole time. And other than the Smithco plant, they got pretty good numbers. So it'll be curious how this works out as we go forward.
Thank you. Dr. Billings, I've unmuted you, but I think you need to unmute yourself to talk.
Looks like your mute's off now, David.
Dr. Billings, you can go ahead. Well, we'll go on to the next question. Dr. Booth has a question. Go ahead, Dr. Booth.
Thank you for the presentation also, and I really admire the job you've done wearing your mayor's hat as well as your surgeon's hat. One thing that watching this go down is that I've noticed is we seem to have a problem with industrial hygiene with this epidemic between LM and Grand Forks, Smithfield, and in Sioux Falls and several other packing plants. How is the business community buying into this? And, you know, are they learning things? And do you see changes permanently made down the road the way they do business?
I'd say yes. I do go out to Pelican Rapids. It's one of my trips out to Fergus Falls and their turkey plant. They have not had cold virus there. So they have been doing the right things in that plant. We also have some large manufacturing plants in the community that we were very concerned about an outbreak, and they have followed good practices. That's why we were very concerned that we'd have a lot of outbreaks in our manufacturing, and we have not seen that. So I think, Mike, I think they will learn from that, and that's one of the things we've talked to people. The new normal will be doing different because you have to protect people getting the virus, so your workplaces have to embrace many of those ideas.
Thanks, Dr. Mahoney. I keep forgetting to unmute myself. I keep laughing at your jokes, and so I have to mute myself. Dr. Billings, one last chance if you'd want to ask Dr. Mahoney a question. Maybe it was a mistake. All right, well, thanks. And Tim, if you want to maybe stay on the line, and if somebody has another question, I'd offer that up too. And so I'll hand it over to Dr. Nagpal. Unmute and start your video. There you go.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for inviting me to this meeting. I just want to take a moment to acknowledge what this represents, despite all the challenges that we have been facing. Here is a meeting of everybody who is working together to make things better. Public health, our mayor, a hospital clinician in me, and all of you working in the front lines, and our medical association representing us. So, and this is what it will take to get us safely through this. And I have been very, very lucky and very impressed with how we have responded and worked together. Believe it or not, however hard it has been, this has been professionally one of the most satisfying things that I've done. And that's what I mean is the relationships we have developed and the way we have come together to address a common goal. So something good has really come out of this, despite all the challenges, or maybe because of the challenges. And I think multiple people, multiple organizations have stepped up to face that challenge and done a fantastic job. I want to acknowledge how well North Dakota has done as compared to the rest of the country. We started off with the aim of keeping our curve flat. 8 weeks into it, we have done that successfully. I do realize that with the businesses opening up again, we will see our case numbers rise, but I'm actually very thankful for the time we have had to prepare for what comes and what we will be dealing with over the next few months. And I think we have utilized our time well, whether it is to protect and prepare our healthcare workers, whether it is to give time to our health department to ramp up their supplies and their capacity for contact tracing, testing, what have you. The communications that they have sent out have been precise and excellent and well thought out. So I think I'm very happy with the way we have all come together and responded to this. I don't have much to add besides what Dr. Connell and Dr. Mahoney have already said. I think I would like to take more questions than anything. And I do want to talk about a few things that came up previously in discussion with the other experts on the call. As far as antibody is concerned, I think for me as an ID clinician and a fake epidemiologist, I think the real utility of antibody testing is purely epidemiological at this point in time. I think our numbers are very low, and we don't have enough data on sensitivity and specificity of the test. And it's a purely IgG test, so I think there is no diagnostic utility from the antibody serology testing at this point in time. So I think what we need to do, how we need to use it, the best way to use it is for epidemiological purposes, by which I mean seroprevalence studies. As far as therapeutics is concerned, somebody asked a question about remdesivir. I just want to point out that we don't have the data. FDA gets to review the data first, and then it is published for peer review. And by peer review, I mean not a peer review before publishing in a medical journal. I mean peer review in its truest sense, which is review of data by frontline clinicians like us to see whether the findings apply to our patient population or not. And as this data becomes available, we'll draw our conclusions and see what comes out of it. But what I can say for sure is that the way remdesivir is being rolled out, or the data we have right now, tells you how difficult it is to find a magical cure for a particularly vexing problem. And there is no, there is not going to be a magic cure or a magic pill or a magic drug. What it will take is what we are doing right now, doing the little things right and working together and having a multidisciplinary approach. What we need to do is have a good public health infrastructure, be aggressive with case finding, be aggressive with contact tracing. We will need to prepare our healthcare workers and our hospitals to handle the influx of patients. We will need to do the supportive care right, ventilator management right. There might be a role for prophylaxis, whether it is in the form of vaccine or a drug. And there will be a role for remdesivir maybe, or some pre-existing drug which is being repurposed, or development of new therapeutics, which will not have 100% efficacy, but even if it has a 20% efficacy, 50% efficacy, that will be a tool for us to do. We'll have to do our infection control practices right. We'll have to make sure that our healthcare workers know how to don and doff. We need to be absolutely clear with our messaging on what the right kind of PPE is. We need to realize that what the correct risk perception is. I think when the information is coming at you hard and fast in a 24/7 news cycle, our risk perception increases quite a bit to a level which is doesn't really reflect the reality of the situation. And that makes our risk tolerance go down quite a bit. We need to realize that nothing is 100%, no intervention is 100% effective, and it's a bundle of interventions that keep you safe and allow you to do the job to the best of your ability. There was some discussion about convalescent plasma. Again, same thing. I don't think it's the magic drug. I don't think it's the magic intervention, but even if it gives us decreased length of stay, we'll take it. Even if it prevents people from going into cytokine storm, getting into ARDS, not ending up on the ventilator, we'll take it. That's a win. Of course, I don't expect it to give 100% efficacy, but even if it gives us 10% efficacy, 20% efficacy, I think it's worth it. We'll take that at this point in time. This is what we do with influenza. Our vaccine was 50% effective this year. We have some kind of therapeutic intervention in the form of both prophylaxis and therapy, in which is the Tamiflu. So, and then we have we tell our healthcare workers to stay home when they are sick, wear a mask, and these are all interventions that work well to flatten the curve for influenza, keep our caseloads down, or at least keep it to the level that can be managed in the hospital. So we need to continue to do these little things well. And as we develop more tools, we will need to continue to approach this from a multidisciplinary standpoint. So that's all I have to say, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Nagpal. Very good. I've got one question from Dr. Govan. Any insight as to why there has not been as much infection of COVID in the adolescent age group? Should schools be allowed to resume?
Great question. So I think the studies that epidemiological studies that we are seeing now come out do suggest that adolescents and children do get an infection. They just don't have as severe of manifestations. So there are probably higher rates of asymptomatic colonization or asymptomatic infection or mildly symptomatic infection. Having said that, there have been no outbreaks where a child has acted as an index case. Now, I don't know whether that's because the schools are all closed or whether because a child who doesn't develop symptoms cannot transmit the disease effectively. So these are unknowns right now. And, you know, I think we need to take a graded approach. We cannot just open up everything at the same time. And that, I think the state has that right for now, opening up businesses in phase one, you know, sticking to the mantra of smart restart. I think we need to wait a little bit till we know more about transmission of infection in children. You know, the other argument being, not all schools are closed. I mean, daycares are still open, and still, we haven't heard of any outbreak starting at a daycare or a child causing an index, being an index case and causing a family cluster. So this is encouraging data, but for practical purposes, I think it's safer to keep the schools closed for now. But as we move forward, we'll see how opening up the businesses affects our case numbers and our hospital capacities. And if we are in a good place in a couple of weeks or 3 weeks, 4 weeks, then maybe it's worth having a discussion about opening up the schools again. And I think it's hard to predict the future. We just need to take it one step at a time. Things change very rapidly in a COVID world. So I will have to see what other states are doing. And we are behind the curve, luckily, as compared to the rest of the country. So we'll get more data from other states opening up to see how their numbers rise or don't rise. And then we can make an informed decision about the schools.
Thank you. I was interested in that question too, so thanks, Gigi, for asking. Anybody else? Questions for Dr. Nagpal? Anything going on, Dr. Nagpal, at Sanford that you feel has contributed to the low curve that we're having?
Well, I would like to take credit for it, but I don't know how much I can. I think the credit has to go to the Department of Health at State, who has been very aggressive with contact tracing and case finding, and also to our leaders, Mayor Mahoney, Governor Burgum, who have really managed the anxiety well and have been really consistent on the message and have given us time to prepare the hospital to handle a surge of patients. We, you know, I think we have utilized our time well. I will say that for Sanford, that they have utilized their time very, very well. They have been very receptive to the data, and they have been very aggressive with preparation, and they have used their the enterprise bargaining power to ramp up our PPEs, supplies, testing supplies, increasing our testing capacity, opening up drive-through testing. And I think that has played up in great part, in kind of aggressive case finding and isolation and keeping the curve flat. And it has also given us time to increase our bed capacity, procure more ventilators, polish our policies and procedures, and do the troubleshooting. And I've been very happy with the way they have handled the special care unit and the expansion and the surge plans in the hospital. I'm very thankful for the time that we got with the closure over the last 4 weeks.
Thank you. Dr. Missy Anderson, I bet you it's a tough one too.
Thanks for the warning.
Misty, you're unmuted.
Oh, I typed it in because I just thought that was easier, but I was just asking about active cases at Samford, like how many you have and how the patients are doing, because we got a little update last week from like Minot and Grand Forks.
So, as of this morning, there were 13 in the ICU and 9 on the med-surg unit. Out of 13 in the ICU, 11 were on the ventilator. So, our case count has been between 20 to 25 all week long. We kind of expected a little bit more surge this week, considering how our nursing home facilities were struggling. That has not panned out so far, thankfully, but I don't know what next week will bring. But we have consistently been at a 20 to 25 number all week long. What we are seeing is exactly what we observed in other parts of the country, which were hit a lot harder and a lot earlier than we were, that a lot of people who end up in the hospital need ICU care. And once you get intubated, it's very hard to get you extubated. And, we have been using all these medications, like hydroxychloroquine, tocilizumab, convalescent plasma, and unfortunately, the results have not been very encouraging, especially in patients who have been in ICU. It's very hard to get them off the ventilator, and that's why I'm saying that we need to do the small little things right with supportive care. I think that remains our mainstay of treatment. And this will become a problem going forward. It's not just the rising case numbers that you are dealing with. It's also our inability to get the patients off the vent. So we will see a lot of patients who will need a tracheostomy, and they will need a ventilator for a long time, and we won't be able to free up the ventilator. So I think do expect to see what our rate limiting step becomes is the number of ventilators we have in every hospital.
Well, thank you. I'm going to leave it open. Any questions for any of our panelists? I want to express appreciation for everybody for taking the time to be with us. We've had some great feedback on these webinars. I think people really appreciate the chance to hear the local. We get a lot of things nationally, and it's really nice to hear what's going on here in North Dakota from our leaders. And I know Dr. Nagpal, he's on the committee with Joan, the Physician Advisory Committee, and he's made great contributions during that. Next week,
I was wondering if Dr. Nagpal would like to come back next week or week after that to give us like a profile of the inpatient, because Fargo seems to have the most patients. What were their presentations? What were their outcomes? What were their interventions? I'm sure you can get one of the residents or students or someone to compile that data if you have already not done that. We would be really grateful to get some local input. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So we do have a Samford registry, which combines our patient experience here at Fargo, Bismarck, and Sioux Falls. So I think we'll have a good data set to analyze that. But so far, what we have seen is exactly what you're hearing from your colleagues over in East Coast or West Coast and the major metro areas, that people do present with silent hypoxia. They look okay, but their oxygen saturations are very low. And the ones who crash do so very quickly going from being able to text on the phone and talk in full sentences to being on the ventilator in no time at all. So that presents some clinical challenges to us. Because then you don't know who you can safely discharge home on oxygen. Yesterday, we tried to discharge a patient on 1 liter of oxygen at home, came back right away and is intubated today. So these are, the usual clinical experiences that you rely on to identify the way, the trend that the patient is showing, that's become a major challenge right now with this disease, because you really don't know which way the patient is going to go. And yes, you can use some clinical markers, some inflammatory markers, but there's a reason why don't we have a clinical scoring system for COVID yet, because it is very hard to predict who's going to decompensate. And when they decompensate, they do it very quickly. And most of our patients who get admitted to the hospital have a very typical story. They have been sick for 3 to 5 days, and it's just not improving, and they feel chest tightness. Some of them are confused because of hypoxia, and some of them think that there's something just not right with them, and they don't typically keep come crashing in first time around. But there are patients who don't present to the ER, and then when they decompensate rapidly, then they come crashing into the ER. So all of those stories that you're hearing from your colleagues on the coast are actually true.
Thank you. A sobering thought. I will be in touch with you, Dr. Nagpal, about next week. We do have Dr. Carson and Dr. Nasheen up next week, which is already May 5th. And maybe we can have an infectious disease panel planned for next week. So if we don't have any other comments or questions, I will wrap up. And again, thanks for everyone's attendance. Thank you, panelists. Excellent presentations. I'm keeping up my reputation on these, so thank you. Goodbye, everybody.
Can I get one word in before you guys leave? Speaking of contact tracing and the need for more bodies always, we would really like the medical students to get involved with this. And Dr. Warren is working on a project, but we really need like Dr. Kumar and Dr. Booth. We need the people who are being in charge of the clerkships to kind of step up and precept these students. So we can talk offline about this, but that's a big need right now. So we can get our medical students some exposure to this and some help for the health department. The other thing I am really in need of, we have those homeless shelters, and I think I discussed this, Devil's Lake, Minot, Grand Forks, Williston, Bismarck, Fargo, Dickinson, Jamestown. And we're working with the community health centers who can serve as the medical home and also possibly provide some nursing in some of these communities. And in some of these communities, we need physician providers just to serve as a medical home in case the nurse needs to call, and we need nursing staff. So please think about this and explore it and reach out to me. Thanks.
Dr. Booth, do you have a comment?
Regarding the medical student volunteers, Joan, the email went out to the students with just that request, so hopefully you'll be hearing from some shortly.
That'd be super. And that for volunteers, that'd be great. But also for the elective that's trying to be set up, we're going to need some preceptors, because I keep getting drawn into this, and my boss has said no. So I can't precept students right now. Sorry.
I'm a dean. They won't let me do evaluations, so I'm kind of stuck. Maybe we can work something out.
All right. Thanks, everybody. See you next week.
Bye.